Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley, and with me is my co-host and mother, Caroline Kilborn.
And hello, everyone. I hope it's a nice day wherever you are.
I hope so, too. How's the weather there in Iowa, Mom?
Well, it's a little bit summery. It's not too bad. It's not too bad. There's a breeze today, so it's not too bad.
And it's summery here in Texas, too. Paula, where are you?
I am in Seattle, and it's gray with kind of big, angry-looking clouds, which is not typical of Seattle. Our clouds are usually pretty happy-looking.
Well, our guest today is Paula Becker, the author of A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction. Paula is the author of Looking for Betty McDonald, The Egg, The Plague, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, and I, and co-author of The Future Remembered, the 1962 Seattle World's Fair and Its Legacy, and Alaska Yukon Pacific Exposition, Washington's First World's Fair. And Paula is at home in Seattle, Washington. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Paula.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for getting through those long, long titles.
So let's see. I think I maybe paused at the wrong places. I think Looking for Betty McDonald, The Egg, is one book. Is that true?
No, that's all. The Egg, The Plague, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, and Diets.
Oh.
It's a very long subtitle.
Okay. Well, we're going to have to learn a little bit about that, and I have a feeling that all of your previous books are very different from what we're looking at today, A House on Stilts.
Absolutely.
Which is informational, but also a memoir of your own story with your son, Hunter, and your whole family. And the first, well, let's talk a little bit about your writing background. So what is Looking for Betty McDonald, The Egg, The Plague, Mrs. Pigglewiggle, and I about?
So that book is a biography of the beloved American author Betty McDonald, who wrote a book called The Egg and I, published in 1945, that went on to become a worldwide bestseller, actually has never gone out of print since 1945, and has had hundreds of different editions in different languages. And Betty McDonald did most of her writing here in Seattle on Vashon Island, a little island near Seattle. And I had written about her for quite a few years for a website that I write for, which is a history website called historylink.org. And it's a history encyclopedia. I felt like Betty's reputation was getting to a point where a lot of her original readers were gone, and many of the children, grandchildren of those readers who had been introduced to Betty's work by, you know, people who had just loved it when it first came out, were starting to go, too. And I felt like I wanted to kind of paste her back into the conversation, and that's why I wrote that book.
And when was The Egg and I published?
1945.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, Mom, are you familiar with that book?
No, I was.
Oh my gosh, that surprises me. Well, I'll give you a brief little recap of The Egg and I. Betty, it's all of Betty's books for adults. She wrote four books that we would now consider memoirs, although that wasn't the kind of the term wasn't applied to books like that at the time. And she also wrote the Mrs. Pigglewiggle books for children, which maybe some of your listeners will have more familiarity with those books. The Egg and I is Betty's story of being a very young bride on a chicken ranch in rural Washington State, and of the kind of her neighbors, basically, who help her get through things but also provide a lot of amusement for her. And the name that may be familiar to people is Ma and Pa Kettle. Betty.
Oh, I was going to say, that was made into a
right.
movie.
Many movies. There was a series of movies.
Okay, also, now you got me. Yeah.
Yeah, a movie of the egg and I where Claudette Colbert and Fred McMurray.
So. Yeah, now I know what you're talking about.
Okay, good.
But I don't.
Mrs. Pickle-Wiggle.
No, but Mon, the words or the name Mon Pa Kettle are familiar to me, but I couldn't tell you who they are or what they are.
Well, they're kind of, your prototypical yokels. And Betty actually did base those characters, well, her books were nonfiction bestsellers, so we could say those characters were her neighbors. Mm-hmm. And the neighbors upon whom she based the Ma and Pa Kettle characters got angry with her and sued her, and there was a big lawsuit here in Washington in the early 50s. And actually, the jury found for Betty, although she claimed in court that she had made everything in the whole book up except for herself and her family, which was an interesting thing to think about considering it was a nonfiction bestseller. But no one seemed to really be surprised or, be troubled by the fact that she testified that she made it up, which she did not.
Okay. Well, in some sense, a memoir is always from one person's perspective, and you're kind of making up some of, if you've got other characters in there, it's just your perspective of them. It's not necessarily who they are. So,
well, I wouldn't say you're making it up.
No.
Because you're giving your own impression of all events, of course, obviously.
Right.
That's also in some ways true of biography. The perspective of the person writing the book is going to, come through in many ways. The thing about memoirs, we're tasked, especially now in this era, with absolutely a bright line on truth. And memoirs, you'll almost never find one that doesn't start with a little kind of a disclaimer that says, I've altered some of the characteristics of the people in this book and certain, defining characteristics about the towns in order to, give privacy to the people I've written about. Mm-hmm. But that being said, it still is the truth of the person who's writing the memoir, or that's what it is supposed to be.
It's kind of a tightrope to walk there because don't want to,
I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a tightrope. I would say that the decision to write a memoir, well, not to write it. Anybody can write a memoir and put it in the drawer and say, okay, I did that, and I, for whatever reason, it was therapeutic, or I just wanted to see if I could, make sense of this story, but not publish it. So anyone can do that. The decision to seek publication is a bigger decision, and I think for me, it involved really trying to grapple with whose story I was telling, whose story this was. And ultimately, I decided that it was my story and that I had the right to tell it. And I think that most people who write memoir of any kind of sensitive nature, they do, have to really think about, would I be stopped by someone's reaction? Mary Carr, who, of course, has written a lot of memoir, the Liars Club, and she actually teaches memoir. She, in her book about memoir, she talks about how she doesn't ask permission of the people that she's writing about, but she will sometimes give them a heads up that she has written about them. But that what she's been surprised about over the years is that the things that make people upset are never the things she thinks is going to make them upset. She might say, she kept whiskey bottles, under her bed, and what that person will say to her is, I can't believe you wrote that I dye my hair.
Well, you never know, do you?
So in your case, you are an accomplished writer. You've been writing for years, but, you wrote this biography, and some pretty heavy-duty history-based nonfiction books.
Yes.
So writing a memoir was very different. And what, you know, you did talk about, you decided that it was your story to tell, but why don't you tell the listeners a little bit about what the story is?
So A House on Stilts is the story of how I changed and my family changed as a result of my son, Hunter, my oldest son, his addiction to heroin and to other drugs, but primarily to heroin. As you can imagine, this is a big, big story. And I think a lot of families that have something like that going on in them, some kind of addiction, and especially right now, you know, middle class, upper middle class mm-hmm. families that are grappling with opioid addiction, that is a big, big, sometimes secret, and it is something that some families feel a great deal of shame about. And I didn't feel ashamed during the years that we were going through this with Hunter, which was basically from about the time he was 15, sort of building up from 15 to 18, and then until his death at 25. I didn't feel ashamed because I was always clear on the fact that I wasn't the one doing it. You know, I wanted to make him stop. I wanted to make him better. I didn't feel like there was anything about anything that I was doing or had ever done that was resulting in Hunter's heroin addiction. So I didn't feel shame about it, but I did feel very isolated. I felt at the time like I didn't know anybody who was going through this. I didn't know anybody else. And part of the reason that I wrote A House on Stilts, and I started writing it a number of years ago, was that at the time I didn't feel like there were a lot of books out there that were written from a parent's perspective. There are a lot of books now. There are more books now. Most of them end with the child in recovery. And I think that it's understandable because publishers want a happy ending. But realistically, this kind of addiction is something that families struggle with and continue to struggle with as the person that they love struggles with it, sometimes for their entire life. So
you had to take copious notes and so forth to be able to recall all of this, and that must have been very difficult too.
You know, it's interesting. I relied on various things. The first thing I did, because when you've gone through a child's, you know, sort of tumble into drug addiction and you're dealing with that while at the same time, you know, having your life and having your job, and my husband Barry and I have two other children younger than mm-hmm. Hunter, so taking people to ballet lessons and, you know, all the things that you're doing the whole of family life, at the same time this addiction thing is coming at you harder and harder and harder like a fire hose. So there were things that had happened that I couldn't remember when they happened, the order that they happened in. And I started by, this is how I decided to write about this. I wasn't saying I'm going to publish this as a memoir. I was saying I want to figure out what order things happened in. I need a timeline. You know, I write history. I am interested in chronology, and I can't remember my own chronology with this. And so I said to Barry, without telling him what I was doing, would you just write me down like what you remember of when things happened with Hunter? And he has a really, really good memory. And so he wrote down like this interaction with the police happened here, and, you know, just basically put things in order for me. And I started writing, and I used my calendars that I kept. I keep a pretty detailed paper calendar. I used, at the time, a huge heap of my own kind of desperate notes that I would take when I was on the phone with the school counselor, or, you know, trying to get him into a different school, or, you know, all these different times that I would be on the phone for hours or taking notes. I used all of that stuff. I had saved that. And then eventually, many, many not many, but, you know, years later when I decided that I was actually going to put this together and try to get it published, I had access to some of Hunter's own materials because I didn't have a lot of his stuff. I had very little from when he was an adult, but when he left the house at about 18, he left, of course, you know, all his high school papers and things like that heaped up. And there would be various points where Hunter would come and kind of go through those materials. And so I call them materials because I'm a historian. I always feel like, you know, they're materials to me. They were his papers. He would go through and he threw things away. Unfortunately, I wish I had access to everything. But the stuff that was still here had some really rich information for me about what Hunter was going through or his piece of it. Like, for example, when he did an Outward Bound course, we sent him to an Outward Bound course when he was in high school and was struggling very much. And he was required to keep a journal on that Outward Bound course. Well, that journal was in there, a journal he had to keep at his first try at rehab. That was in there too. And even just little notes and scraps of paper, things that I mention in the book very specifically, like there was a list that I found on one side of the paper was this really beautiful sketch of the dissection of a frog, like he'd been doing in science class, you know, keeping track of that. And then on the other side of the piece of paper was this list of, you know, drugs and alcohol and cigarettes that he was planning on buying, like a shopping list for this festival that happens in Seattle every year, that he was planning on going to. And it was like, you know, the dichotomy of, but to have that piece of paper, to have it in my hand when I was writing about it, not only did it let me really accurately describe it, and it let me remember that moment of what that kid was like, you know, who drew the beautiful frog and made a shopping list that was basically like, you know, the old story of the bank robber who's caught with a list that says rob bank.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Paula Becker, author of House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction. You know, Paula, I got to admit that I'm impressed that you didn't take, like, the guilt and the shame on yourself. That actually is shows a lot of strength of character, because it's so hard not to feel like whatever your kids do is a reflection on you. And how do you think you were able to avoid that trap?
You know, I mean, I think a lot of people do this. I'm not saying that I'm unique in this, but I taxed myself from the time I had kids. Well, I was always that person who never wanted to do anything wrong, right? You know, the one who didn't want the teacher mad at her and would, like, a pleaser. And when I had kids, I really taxed myself with mothering being my job that was above anything else that I was doing. And I think in some ways that's not always the best way to go. But I really paid such attention to the choices that I was making and to the way that the children and I interacted. And I felt like everybody was doing really, really well, like I was succeeding at this job. And we had a number of years where we homeschooled, and I was really with the children all the time, and everybody was flourishing. Everybody was doing well. Hunter was doing well. The other kids were doing well. And this was part of what actually was confusing for me when Hunter stopped doing well. It took me a really long time to see what was happening when he was in adolescence as not being, you know, done by that 11-year-old. So when he was so rational and doing so great and being this happy, you know, reading all the time and drawing and, you know, great with math kind of kid, and then he was this you know, teenager who was sneaking out all the time and, you know, smelling like marijuana and, you know, the first beginning pieces of it, I kept thinking, I know this kid so well. I know how rational he is. And what I'm seeing is an aberration, and he's going to snap back. And that was a mistake. Like, when I say I don't criticize myself for his becoming addicted to heroin, but there are definitely places along the road that now, with hindsight, I wish that I had done differently. I try not to judge myself for those decisions because I really know I was making the best decisions I could at the time. But if people ask me now, you know, especially people who might be in a similar situation, what would you have done differently if you had had the benefit of you know, hindsight? I definitely have a list of things I would have done differently. I don't know that that would have made a difference, though,
yeah,
because I think...
That's the thing, you can't know.
Yeah.
You can't know.
You cannot know.
Yeah.
You cannot know. You have to make your best decision every single time, and the best decision, never the right decision. It's just the one that seems less wrong.
And
well, it was territory you didn't know, you know. You'd never been there before, so you
never
didn't have anything to go on.
Yeah. We're really fortunate now, and by we I mean parents and grandparents and, you know, everyone who's interacting with young people, that there are many, many more resources available now. The internet, you can go and, you know, there's an organization called Shatterproof, which is trying to end the stigma and the agony that addiction brings to families. And they're doing things like they have funding to put together a rating system for rehab programs. Now, if you had never dealt with this, you would think, oh, of course there's already a rating system, and you would be completely wrong. So, you know, things and resources, family support groups, and, you know, it's a little bit easier now to put your hands on the information that lets you help your kid. That still doesn't mean you can fix it. But, you know, if you're helping as much as you can, then that's all you can do.
Go ahead, Mom.
When my son was a young man, he got into some trouble. Now, not anything, as far as I know, he was never did any hard drugs at all. But he, you know, did some other things, got in some trouble that was shocking to me because I just did not see that how this could have happened. And I felt guilty, and what did I do wrong? And I asked him one time, it's like, where did I go wrong? And this is, you know, he was like 19 at the time, and he said, Mom, I had a better childhood than anyone I know. It was nothing you did.
Yes, you're very fortunate in that, and I was very fortunate in that, because even when Hunter was at the, you know, what was some of the worst and most painful times of his young adult life, when he was living on the streets and you know, in the throes of active addiction, he would say to me, unprompted by me, he would say, Mom, this is not your fault. You did a great job. You were a great mom. You are a great mom. Don't blame yourself. And I feel so, you know, I mean, blessed is the only word that I have those memories, because I do know other parents now whose kids did not say that, or, you know, and were very angry.
Or actively
blame them, yeah. And that would be, you know, that would be a lot to sit with. That would be a lot.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. Okay, tell us about the title of the book, where that came from.
Okay. A House on Stilts was an actual thing in our backyard. So when we have a small house in a small backyard, and when Hunter was a little boy, about 6 years old, he said, well, you know, why can't we have a tree house? And I said, well, the apple tree is like a twig. It would never hold up a house. And he said, well, why don't we build a house on stilts? And Barry said, wow, well, draw a picture for us of what that would look like. And Hunter designed this basically like a playhouse, but up on stilts. So it was about 4 feet up. And he and Barry went to great, great lengths to, like, go to a marine supply store and get special kind of portholes. And they went to a climbing store, and they got climbing holds, and they drilled all these holes on the side of it and then put the climbing holds in. And there were special windows that were stained glass that they got from the salvage store. So it was this really cool, funky, you know, kind of a playhouse in the backyard. And it was about, I would say, you know, 8, 10 by 12 or something. So it was big. It was like a bedroom, sort of. And the kids played in there all the time. There were slumber parties. They played games out there. When their friends would come, they would take the board games out there or play cards or whatever. And during a period of time when Hunter was not able to live in our house because he was actively using heroin, and, you know, I hope that your listeners will never be confronted with a situation where they have to put their child out of the house. That happened to us when Hunter was 18 years old. And, you know, we had two other younger children living in the house. And, you know, that it couldn't happen. So he lived he was various places. But one of the things he did was he started staying in the house on stilts. And we said that
this might be a good time to read from the prologue.
Sure, that sounds good. That sounds good. Of course, I want to say also that the title becomes metaphor for the rickety nature.
That's right.
What we're going through. So I'm going to just read the prologue from the book A House on Stilts. I'm in the kitchen baking lemon black sesame seed muffins for my 18-year-old son, Hunter. It is a bright mid-July morning, and the sunlight is a soothing coda to the gray Seattle spring we've recently endured. Hunter is newly home from a 3-month drug rehab program where, his father and I desperately hope, he has been yanked back from his recent plunge into prescription opioid abuse. Our lives have veered savagely off the placid road that Hunter and his younger siblings, Sawyer and Lily, traveled with us in the years before Hunter started using drugs. Our old, safe patterns have become unfamiliar territory, but I am endeavoring to hold on to what is still familiar, baking these small mouthfuls of comfort, a new variation on a recipe I've followed perhaps 100 times. These should be lemon poppy seed muffins, since those are Hunter's favorites. This batch is meant to be a welcome home treat for him. But Hunter's sobriety, so fresh, prompts me to substitute black sesame seeds. Poppies are opiates, after all. Consuming them might spur a positive response on the opioid urine tests we are administering randomly. I take conservative precaution, substituting the benign dark specks for their narcotic counterpart. Hunter, meanwhile, unbeknownst to me, is downstairs in his basement bedroom shooting heroin. We realize, finally, we confront. Hunter bangs out the front door, running, clutching his bag of drugs, shouting, "These can't be in our house," to me, bound for the street again. Once he is gone, I knit all day, huddled beneath a quilt in the overstuffed armchair where Hunter used to fall asleep when he was a toddler, board books and goldfish crackers by his side. I breathe, light some incense, knit some more. I write a poem, trying to frame the pain, to puncture it, pin it down like a butterfly fixed to a board, to contain it, but still it seeps and stains. None of my tricks deliver me to solid ground. There is no comfort, and I cannot find a way to save my son. Memories shimmer before me, Hunter's sweet young face, his guileless laughter, his strong small arms slung around my neck as he jumped up to hug me. Where is that little boy? What part of him still lives inside this drug-addicted teenager? Hunter's drugs mean that he cannot live with us. But we decide that on nights when he can't find a friend or fellow forlorn one to take him in, he can sleep in what we call the house on stilts, a treeless treehouse in our small backyard. He comes and goes. I leave fresh boxer shorts, jeans, a t-shirt. He leaves his dirty clothes, redolent of cigarette smoke and perspiration. I leave a sandwich, a box of Lily's homemade cookies, a bottle of water, vitamins, his toothbrush. He leaves a Q-tip, cotton coaxed from its tip for what I guess must be no healthy purpose. We do not know when he will come and go. Stealthily he avoids us, coming after dark, leaving before dawn. But I look out the kitchen window, and when my son is present, the stained glass windows of the house on stilts glow with the light of the small lamp within, like a church on Christmas Eve. This is my only solace, and it is fleeting, and I cling to it as I once clung to him, sweet-smelling, freshly bathed. Parenting publications often refer to parenting as a journey, promising to help moms and dads navigate each turn from birth to launch. I contributed for years to a local magazine called Parent Map, such a reassuring title. Because, hey, if there's a map, parents can buy one, borrow one, forecast the road to come. Maps mean cartographers have charted the way, road builders have leveled and landscaped it, or at the very least, some traveler has scratched the path with ciphers suggesting left is easy walking, right is the cliff. But being the parent of a teenager with addiction is like trying to navigate a dark room blindfolded. You bump around, desperate for clarity, feeling the objects in your path to try and figure what they are, tripping, falling. Occasionally your blindfold shifts enough that you catch a glimpse, in that infinitesimally less dark moment, of what the room contains. Then the blindfold slips back, the darkness rendered even blacker by the fragment of paler dark. We were a family just like yours, perhaps. We loved and protected each other, read Harry Potter books, picked apples and peeled them and added sugar and cinnamon and baked them into pies. We followed the recipe. We followed the rules. Barry and I knew we were not perfect, but we could sometimes feel perfection in the moments we shared. People who looked at us thought, blessed children, lucky mom and dad. We did not know it when we lived these years. But we were taking part in opioid addiction's horrific zeitgeist. We numbered among the now legion middle and upper middle class families previously privileged not to have experienced opioids' ruinous effects, among the parents who thought their children impervious to this scourge. America flails now in the teeth of the wolf that is addiction. Opioids, black market, and legally prescribed have become, for millions of families, their personal pathology. Families have always struggled when a member was abusing, often silently, usually in shame. American society now struggles openly because the growing consumption of illicitly manufactured fentanyl-laced heroin means more people are dying. Use can be disguised or contained within families. Death cannot. We now acknowledge, and we must, that opioid addiction cuts across all barriers, economic, racial, educational, age, and gender. My family's deeply personal story has become universal. This is the story of my journey as a mother down years of unmarked road, of grasping blackness, begging for clarity. It is my story, but there were others walking, sometimes crawling, the path with me, my husband Barry, our middle son Sawyer, our daughter Lily, and Hunter, our beloved eldest child, careening, slashing, plunging, pounding ahead. Some of us think that we can choose our stories, map our journeys. Being Hunter's mother has shown me we cannot.
And that was Paula Becker reading from A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction. So the whole way through the book, I kept hoping there would be a happy ending, even though I knew,
I did too.
Even though I knew that it wasn't. Yeah. But there were so many moments during those years when you were hopeful, and you expressed that hope in such a way that I became hopeful.
Oh, yeah. Even people in my family who absolutely knew that Hunter did not make it have said the same thing to me when they were reading the book, that they kept hoping there would be a different ending.
And he did not die directly from his addiction.
He did not. No, he did not. And that is a strange thing in talking about this book with other families who did lose a child to overdose. Hunter actually was killed by a bus, and that is a strange and terrible thing. You cannot wait the way a person dies. Their death is horrible, the death of a child. And this is a strange and weird twist in a story that had a lot of strange and weird twists. But the result is the same. He is lost to us.
But is there always the thought that if he had lived, maybe this time would have been the time that he stayed clean?
Oh, sure. Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. You know, as long as someone is alive, you know, there is a chance that they'll, you know, get into recovery. And Hunter had periods, when he was in recovery, and he did a lot better during those periods. And I'll tell you, another thing that's different now than when we were going through all this when Hunter was younger is that there's much, much more understanding now in just the general public, but certainly in first responders, you know, to the idea that at least if the overdose is due to an opioid, that the person can be revived with naltrexone, which goes under the brand name of Narcan. And in our state of Washington, anyone can go into a pharmacy and say, I want a prescription for Narcan, and carry that with them. I am carrying it now because partly just to kind of publicize that this is something people can do, but you can better believe that if I had a teenager, even if my teenager was not using drugs to my knowledge, I would have Narcan in the house because people come over to study. And what if it's the cheerleader who you don't know she's taking OxyContin? I mean, you know, let's protect our kids as best we can, you know, and that's something that I feel like is a much, much better known and much more, it's a tool that parents can have in their arsenal. I mean, pray God you don't have to use it, but it is something.
Also, there's more knowledge about what drugs do to the brain. And that's part of the situation. We never brain is so complex, and every human being is different.
Yeah.
And so some people react to drugs differently than other people. And that's they've always known that, but still they keep prescribing the same things for everybody. So
yeah. It's true too, though, that, you know, with a young person, maybe especially young men, I don't know, like, to tell them these are damaging your brain, I mean, I don't know. That's not a story that is too scary to young men who are already taking a lot of risks. And I think it's very important that that there be a lot of wraparound support for kids who are going through a battle with any kind of drug addiction or alcohol addiction. And that means somehow making recovery cooler by having peers who are mentoring each other. And there's some of that that's starting to happen too. We have a high school here in Seattle. It's small, but it's a public high school that's called Recovery High School. And, you know, the kids who are there are in recovery. And I just met some of them the other night. I was on a panel at this place called Recovery Cafe, which, again, another place that people can go and have a social life with people who are in recovery, you know. And it's that kind of idea of having a supportive community, not 12-step is great for some people, and for other people it doesn't resonate. And I think that it's important that there be more than 12-step. I'm not saying there shouldn't be 12-step, but there needs to be lots more so that hopefully something will work for, you know, each person.
And also being more public about it, like, and sharing stories like you have, or, you know, celebrities talking about, you know, being in recovery. And just think back to what, was it Betty Ford? You know, what she did for helping women seek recovery.
Yes. And she was the first celebrity, I believe, who went public, you know, with her struggle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And she made a huge difference.
Yes.
You always wonder, you know, what makes some kids susceptible to this, and why do they start it in the first place? What gets, you know, what can you do to prevent that? And I've often thought about the fact that we spend our children's first dozen years telling them that nothing can hurt them, that we will protect them, that there's nothing, you know, that they're completely safe. And then we're surprised when they act on that belief.
Yes. Yeah. And we convince ourselves that we can keep them safe too. I mean, I have hundreds and hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands, of family photographs, because, you know, when my kids were young, we were still printing out every, you know, the roll
right,
of films.
Right.
And always a duplicate, right? So grandma got some. But, you know, you cannot find one photograph of Hunter where he is on a bike without a helmet, where he's on skis without a helmet, where he's on a snowboard without a helmet. You know, we buckle our kids into car seats, and we should, and we, you know, we do all these things that are best practice. And not only do we keep them safe, we convince ourselves that we will always be able to do that. And that is something that having a child, for me, it was having a child who had drug addiction. For other parents, it's other things. It's a child who gets cancer, or, you know, there can be all kinds of things that make parents realize finally that they don't control it. But for me, this was what made me finally realize it. It was hard for me to get to that point.
Oh, I bet. I know that, you know, throughout the book, when you're telling about different times and, you know, when Hunter was on the street, or when you let him back in the house, or even when he was on the street, but you would go meet him at a coffee shop, and you would bring him food, and you'd buy him coffee, and you struggled with the issue of whether or not you were enabling his addiction. And did you ever like resolve that issue for yourself?
You know, I began eventually, after we had been through many, many years of the many decisions, you know, is this going to help him? Is this going to make it worse? I realized that, for me anyway, the question of was this enabling was less important. I think enabling is a word that is used to shame families who are doing the best that they can. And, you know, I think I tried to hold the criteria, this decision that I'm making right now, if Hunter died tomorrow, could I live with this decision? And that was different. It was different at different times, you know. And when your kids are little, everything's very straightforward. And, you know, the famous thing is, if you don't clean your room, we won't go to Disneyland, right? And then they don't clean it, and it's like, sorry, Disneyland's off. Well, that kind of simplistic reasoning doesn't work very well once their teenager's in it, especially doesn't work very well if they are defiant, and if they're starting to use drugs. You just need a more complicated set of decision-making.
Well,
criteria.
You have to pick your battles.
Yes.
For sure.
You do.
Yeah.
You do.
And so you let things slide that maybe at another point in time might have seemed like something you wouldn't let slide, but you just can't fight every point.
Yeah, and it's, you know, it also, it, when they're younger, maybe it's letting things slide, but also, and things do slide, whether you let them slide or not,
right.
There are things that slide. But when Hunter was older, you know, we, for the last year and a half of his life, a little more than that, we paid for an apartment for him. And we did that even though we weren't 100% sure he had relapsed when we first got into this situation, but he had lost the job that he had, and he begged us to pay for an apartment. And Barry and I had, you know, he'd been a hunter, had been on the street here and in Portland for, you know, more than a year, off and on at different times. And it was, of course, it was terrible for him. It was terrible for us too. It was brutal. It was brutal, and it was paralyzing in many ways. And when we had the situation with him, Lily was a senior in high school. You know, things were going pretty well for everybody else. And we just said, we just can't do this again. We cannot live our lives with any kind of joy knowing that Hunter is on the street. And a lot of people would say, well, you enabled him. You know, you eventually were pretty sure he was using drugs, and you still kept paying that, you know,
yeah,
to get a roof over his head.
It wasn't your role at that point to punish him for using drugs.
Well, and not nor did nor does that work.
Yeah,
nor did I
exactly.
ever. But see, the enabling argument with that goes, and this is sort of a 12-step idea. You know, they need to hit bottom, and then they'll decide that they don't want to use drugs anymore. Well, I don't believe in that. I think bottom is so much more complicated. I mean, people can decide, for various reasons, I'm not going to do this anymore. And people do that. And I'm not saying that it's, you know, an easy thing, but there are people who, like, I know a man who, you know, they had their first child, and he said, I'm not drinking anymore. And he just stopped. And, you know, people can do that.
Right. And also, bottom can mean dying.
Yes, absolutely.
So do you let them hit bottom? It's kind of like that saying, right, whatever doesn't kill you makes you stronger. Yeah, or it kills you.
Or it kills you.
Yeah.
Well, that's it, you know. But like in, you know, a lot of people would say that it was enabling to do that. And for Barry and me, we were like, you know what? This is what we're going to do. We need to do it. And this is, you can say it's enabling, but it is compassionate, you know. We need a little more compassion.
Let me ask you about these rehab centers. There are a lot of them, a lot of different ones out there, apparently.
Oh, my
gosh.
And
how do you know which ones are good and which ones are not?
Well,
is there,
you know,
is some criteria?
Yeah. Not yet. I mean, really, there are certain things like there'll be, you know, different states have different rules on this, and different insurance companies have different ideas of what kind of rehab they're willing to fund if you're lucky enough to have insurance. And there's the Obamacare, you know, brought in some protections for people who needed rehab and sort of forced insurance companies to cover that. I very much fear, you know, the future of all of that. But this is why I mentioned Shatterproof, and that they're trying to put together an evidence-based rating of rehab centers. Evidence-based meaning, you know, that there are criteria and that there are certain safeguards in place. It doesn't exist yet. I would say right now for people, you know, you Google it and, oh, my gosh, all you get is places that you get a lot of paid advertised places. I think you have to really dig down deeply, and what I would say is that there are various, the federal government has a page that lets you try to find a rehab place in your area. You still have to do a lot of asking, and it's a good idea if you can be in touch with, you know, if you have a therapist who does this kind of work with people with addiction, you know, just getting references. But the other thing is, a lot of times, you know, places have enormous, enormous costs. I mean, you know, $15,000-$20,000 for a month is upward to, I've seen $70,000 or even more for 1 month of rehab.
Oh,
now that's at one end of the spectrum. But And, you know, it's a really complicated issue because you want this person to have a reset, and that's really important. And there are some families who have a kid go through, you know, 10, 15, 20 rehabs. And, you know, at a certain point, I think it gets to be obvious that the person with the addiction has to want to be in recovery, that they have to be at a point where they want that, you know, more than even their families. But it's so complicated because I do think addiction is a disease, and I think that, you know, treatment for that disease and opportunity for the person's brain to rest from what the substances do to it are a big, big part of successful recovery.
Mm-hmm.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Paula Becker, author of A House on Stilts, Mothering in the Age of Opioid Addiction. Paula, I'm wondering how Barry and Sawyer and Lily did react to you publishing, you know, were they completely supportive of you publishing this story?
Yes, I would say. Yeah, definitely. And Barry, you know, bless him. Not only did he live through all these years with me, he read countless drafts and different iterations of this book. And really, you know, it's both our stories. Although, of course, in the end, it's my view. Sawyer and Lily were both very supportive of me writing it. Lily has read the book and said to me, there is so much that happened that I had no idea was happening at the time. And I thought, yes, that's good, because I was trying not to have you guys be like, you know, bam, 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 everything that was hitting, you know, burying me. I mean, obviously they knew very much what was going on, but like just some of the specific details.
Right, right.
I was glad she had been spared those as an 11-year-old. Sawyer has the book. He's supportive of its existence. It's hard. I don't know if he's read it, because it's hard. You know, Sawyer and Lily had their own relationships with Hunter that were, you know, wonderful in many ways and complicated in many ways. And Sawyer's 3 years younger than Hunter. They were very close as little boys. And, you know, I can't tell the story of how Sawyer felt about Hunter, how Lily feels, or Barry. I can just tell mine.
Yeah, and I noticed in the book you didn't try to. You didn't try and tell this, you know, how Sawyer felt or how Lily felt. And at the time I wondered about that, but now that you've explained it, it makes perfect sense.
It was a very deliberate choice, and I had a wonderful editor at University of Iowa Press, James McCoy, and he asked me at one point, well, you know, what about Sawyer and Lily? Do you want to put more of their stories into this? And I said, no. No. You know, I feel like, you know, writing about our children is, it's like walking on razor blades. And I was not willing to, put my impression of their relationship into the book. I didn't think that was appropriate. They can write their own books if they want to.
It also really seems like you and Barry stayed very united and cohesive throughout this. That must be unusual in this situation. And was it really were you as united as you appear to be in the book?
We really were. And again, that's something, like I said, I feel like Hunter telling us, you know, telling me I did it, was doing a good job and it wasn't my fault, is a blessing. The fact that, you know, our marriage survived this intact is also an enormous blessing. We often agree about things. We just always have. Not, you know, everything, but like we rarely disagree about the color to paint the room, or, you know, the sofa cushion or whatever. And bigger things too, much bigger things with the children. We just tend to agree, and with the way that we responded to Hunter, it was together.
We don't know how any one person will react to a drug of any kind, because we don't understand, nobody understands the brain completely. I don't think there's any doctor that, you know, has a handle on it, but we do the best we can, and they do the best they can. But I think that you and your husband did fantastically well. I mean,
oh, thank you.
So, Paula, you know, when you decided to publish this book, how did you go about finding your publisher?
Well, that's an interesting story. You know, this is my fourth book, you know, you would think that it would be just hop, skip, and a jump. But my first three books, well, I don't have an agent. I don't have a literary agent, so I did not have that as somebody to be shopping the book around for me. I did try with agents, and I feel like with memoir, it's really tricky to get a literary agent interested in you unless, for some reason, they really resonate with your story, or your story resonates, or you have some degree of fame or infamy. And I did not have that kind of fame or infamy. So I decided pretty quickly that I would go to publishers that didn't need an agent, and I had a wonderful experience with looking for Betty McDonald. My publisher was University of Washington Press, which is, of course, here in Seattle. And so I knew how working with a university press could be a very close, kind of an intimate relationship. When the book, it never felt like the book got taken away from me. It was like a handmade thing. And I thought, well, UW Press doesn't do memoirs, but I'm going to look and see which university presses do, you know, put out memoirs. And Iowa was one of them, and I was just lucky that the story resonated with Jim McCoy, and I could tell when we talked on the phone that it had touched him, and that was just wonderful. And you'd think, you know, here's my worst thing that ever happened to me in my whole life, you know, buy it, or, you know, it was just great to hear him get it.
Oh, that's great.
Well, I think, you know, Iowa has its share of addiction issues, for sure. So
find me a place that doesn't.
Yeah,
yeah. Exactly.
I think you're right about that.
Yeah.
Well, listen, Paula, we're out of time, and it was certainly a pleasure having you on today.
Oh, my, yes.
This book, in some ways, is hard to read because it really brings home the point that this could happen to anybody, to anything.
Absolutely.
Anywhere. But it is beautifully written, and speaking with you has been very uplifting.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
And Mom, do you have a closing quote for us?
Yes, I do. If you know somebody who's having a problem like this, a family, try not to judge. We don't know what battles they're fighting. Be kind.
That's a wonderful, wonderful sentiment. I second that.
Well, thank you, Paula. Thank you, Mom. And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.
Thank you so much for having me.